The experience shook Cash, especially because the gunman had selected 11-year-old John Carter as his intended murder victim. He had remained extraordinarily calm, though, and his lack of panic probably ensured their safety. Their homecoming must have been particularly joyous when they returned to Nashville on January 9th for a ceremony renaming a five-mile stretch of Gallatin Road between Drake's Creek Lane and Schutz Lane, Johnny Cash Parkway. In 1983, Cash returned to producer Brian Ahern, who tried to revitalize his sound by bringing him out to Hollywood to record with some of the city's top session musicians, including drummer Hal Blaine, guitarist James Burton, bass player Jerry Scheff, and fiddle player David Mansfield. The title track, Johnny 99, and the opening track, Highway Patrolman, both came from Bruce Springsteen's recently released stripped-down recording Nebraska, which, ironically enough, had been written by Springsteen after repeated listens to Cash's early Sun recordings. Springsteen, a longtime Cash fan, also wrote about blue-collar life, social entrapment, and the need for redemption. "I think Springsteen says it better than any of us did," Cash said. "He's the master of these kinds of songs. He's such a prolific writer. I guess youth has got a lot to do with it. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I was writing more. It's not that I don't have the inspiration. It's just that when I write something, I'm more thorough than I ever was. They take me longer to finish. In the 50s, I would leave them exactly as they came to me. But now I'm aware of the competition of writers like Bruce, and so I work on every line until they're to my total satisfaction. I want my songs to be as good as theirs." There was something ironic about Cash, the great innovator, trying to emulate the work of artists who had originally been inspired by him. Cash's own writing barely came through on his recordings. Of the five albums from Silver to Johnny 99, he contributed only 7 songs and increasingly relied on the work of younger songwriters like Tom T. Hall, Rodney Crowell, and Billy Joe Shaver. He still hadn't abandoned his acting ambitions. In 1981, he'd received a lot of critical acclaim for his role in the CBS TV movie The Pride of Jesse Hallam, which focused on the problem of adult illiteracy. In 1998, he appeared in Murder in Coweta County, a made-for-TV movie based on a novel about a sheriff who attempts to bring a corrupt Georgia land baron to justice. Cash had spent 7 years trying to get a network interested in filming this story. On November 10, 1983, while in Nottingham for the 10th stop on a 12-show European tour, Cash began hallucinating from the combination of drugs and alcohol. Back in his hotel room with June, he became convinced that the wooden wall panels concealed a pull-down bed. June told him not to be ridiculous, but Cash was so sure of what he saw that he began repeatedly punching the wall, because the bed wouldn't budge. He hit the wall with such force that he cut his hand. It became so swollen and infected that, by the time he returned to Nashville 3 days later, he required surgery. Checking into Baptist Hospital for the operation, he learned that he had a much more serious condition. He was suffering from internal bleeding and needed his duodenum and part of his spleen, stomach, and intestines removed. Although he had packed his own stash of Valium and Percodan, these pills became unnecessary once doctors prescribed morphine. Besides relieving his pain, the drug gave him intense hallucinations. He began imagining the hospital as a gigantic plane taking off, circling through the air and landing. At times, he'd react so violently to his imagined flight that he'd flail his arms and knock down the poles holding the IV drips. Meanwhile, those closest to Cash used the opportunity to make plans to admit him to the Betty Ford Center. A doctor from the center flew to Nashville to facilitate an intervention. In his private hospital room, his inner circle attempted to show him, in the clearest terms possible, the effect his selfish behavior was having on those he loved and who loved him. His wife, mother, and children all participated, each having written out a specific example of how his drugs had affected them. "We had to tell him how he was hurting us," says Roseanne. "We told him that it was making him seem distant from us. We told him that we couldn't connect with him when he was in a state like that, that we didn't like the way his personality had changed, and that we all worried about his health and were afraid that he was going to die." John Carter told him how humiliated he had felt when he brought a friend home and his dad was stoned. The challenging session concluded with a simple statement from the doctor. "We all want you to go to the Betty Ford Center." Cash was humbled. He knew that the statements they had read to him weren't written out of vengeance, but out of love and concern. He agreed to go. "It was pretty heavy," says Roseanne, "but he just sat there and nodded." Treatment at the Betty Ford Center in Rancho Mirage, California, close to Palm Springs, is based on a 12-step philosophy. After a complete medical and psychosocial assessment, doctors and patient devise an individualized plan. Patients live in a dormitory and receive no privileges, regardless of their status in society. Celebrity or not, Cash had to make his own bed and vacuum his own room. When he and fellow guest Elizabeth Taylor planned a New Year's Day party complete with ordered-in delicacies, the head of the center stepped in and banned it. Neither of them was used to having anyone tell them what they could or couldn't do, says Lou Robbins' wife, Karen, who visited Cash during his stay. But they got through it. June was surprised that Johnny acquiesced so quickly. The 12-step philosophy requires that addicts acknowledge that they cannot control their own lives without recognizing the power greater than ourselves. The Betty Ford Center distinguishes this spiritual approach from a religious cure. The center's literature emphasizes particular religions, while honored, are separate from the treatment experience, and no specific religion is promoted. When it refers to God, the philosophy is quick to add, as we understand Him. For Cash, who naturally interpreted the 12 steps within a Judeo-Christian framework, nothing clashed with his convictions. The first step forced him to admit his powerlessness over his addiction. The second step, accepting that the power could restore him, led naturally to the third step, in which he had to commit to turning his life over to the power. The program sounded as familiar as the voice of Hal Gallup back in Dias, or Jimmy Snow in Madison. He thought he had learned this lesson in Nickajack Cave the day he wanted to end it all. The fourth step required him to take a moral inventory before he could, as the fifth step, admit to himself and one other person the nature of his wrongs. By the sixth step, he had to be ready to have these defects, or sins as he would have seen them, removed, and by the seventh, he had to ask the power to do so. So far, it was almost like an altar call. The eighth step involved listing everyone he had harmed and being willing to make amends. Actually, making those amends completed the ninth step. For the tenth step, he had to take another personal inventory and admit any further wrongs, and for the 11th step, he had to solidify his bond with the power for guidance and strength. Finally, he had to apply these principles to every area of his life and seek to carry the message to others in the same situation. He stayed at the Betty Ford Center for 43 days. After 3 weeks, he found himself coming alive and enjoying the journey of self-discovery. During family week, he was joined by June, John Carter, manager Lou Robin, and agent Marty Klein, who sat in on sessions in order to monitor progress. We had to go through all the procedures that they were doing over 5 days, says Robin. In some of those sessions, people laid their souls so bare it was embarrassing. The idea was that they would get up in front of the public and talk about themselves. It was a big step. Lou Robin picked up Cash from the center upon his release and took him straight to a hotel restaurant in Palm Springs, where they were joined by Gene Autry. Cash had lost weight, looked more fit than he had in years, and had all the zealousness of a convert to a new way of life. After reuniting with June in L.A., he played a concert that night with Waylon Jennings at the Universal Amphitheater, and afterward tried to persuade Jennings to give up his cocaine habit. "I just want you to see my bright brown eyes to show you what can happen," he told him. "If you ever want help, I know what to tell you to do." According to Karen Robin, the new Johnny Cash took some getting used to. Johnny and June had to work on their marriage after he came back from Betty Ford, she says. He wanted her to be totally accepting of him right away, and she had to tell him to hold back because she wasn't used to him being like this, so sober and lucid all the time, and so excited by what he had learned. I think at first she didn't trust him to have changed so totally, but then she realized that he really had turned a corner. It was quite wonderful.